problems have been compounded by having to pay cash for goods after credit insurers pulled their cover and this hit cash flow. The group was originally part of the American F.W. Woolworth's empire, but has operated as an independent company since 1982. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
Thailand's prime minister has declared a state of emergency at the two largest Bangkok airports. Police have been trying to clear the airports of anti-government protesters. Flights in and out of Bangkok have been canceled. Thousands of passengers are stuck in the capital. Protesters seized the larger of the two airports on Tuesday, the smaller one yesterday. They are trying to unseat the current elected administration. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Support for programs comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings every Saturday from 2 to 6, and beer and spirit tastings on Sundays from 3 to 5. Information at thecorkscrew.com.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. There are people living all over the globe who spend parts of their lives in online virtual worlds. Our guest for this hour of the show, anthropologist Tom Belstorff, spent more than 2 years doing field work in one of the largest of these virtual worlds, Second Life. And this morning, in this hour of our show, we'll be talking about how he tried to apply the methods of anthropology that are used in the so-called real world, we'll put big quotes around that, to explore this new frontier of human life. You can read about this in his book, Coming of Age in Second Life, An Anthropologist Explores the Virtually Human. It's published by the Princeton University Press, out there, I'm sure, in the bookstore, the library, if you'd like to read it. Professor Belstorff, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Well, thanks for talking with us.
Happy to be here.
There were some people, I'm sure, that will know nothing about Second Life. So just to start off here, we should talk about what it is. Just give us the thumbnail sketch of Second Life.
Sure. Well, Second Life is one example of a virtual world. And basically what a virtual world is just a place on the internet where people can go and socialize. And so it's different from email or a website in that it has a kind of persistent existence as an online place. I could leave it and come back a day later and something might have changed. Someone might have built something new inside of the virtual world. So it's based on the same technologies as, you know, the internet in general, and as video games, actually, because many of the biggest virtual worlds are actually very game-oriented, like Worlds of Warcraft or something like that. Mm-hmm. And Second Life is one of these virtual worlds that doesn't have a built-in mandatory gaming element. It's more of an open-ended virtual world where some people do gaming kinds of things and other people do absolutely anything that they want to do.
But it is similar, I guess. I think it's interesting that you do indeed in the book make this distinction between whatever we're going to call Second Life, whatever we say it is, and a game, because it's not a game. And yet, like some of these games, people enter into the virtual world. They have an avatar, a character that represents them that they can choose and choose to make it look like anything they want, something that actually looks like them or something that's completely different, a different gender, a different species, you know, whatever you want to represent you, you do that. And then within this environment, you're interacting with other people who are also sort of doing the same thing.
That's right. Well, one way I've heard some people describe it that actually I think is very accurate is that a football stadium is not a football game. You have a game in a football stadium, but the stadium isn't the game. And in that sense, Second Life is a world, a virtual world. It's a place. And it can have games inside of it, but doesn't have to. It's quite open-ended in that sense. And there are many of these kinds of virtual worlds coming into existence more and more all the time, and they have a history to them. And very often they are associated with games and or role-playing, which isn't quite the same thing as a game, but sort of taking on a different identity or that kind of thing. But none of that is inevitably the case for virtual world.
Yeah, and I guess I could see some people saying, well, I sort of understand the idea of a role-playing game where you have many different players. They could be all over the world playing. They have characters that represent them in the games, and it takes place in some kind of a fantasy universe, which is completely unlike the lives that we lead. Some people, I suppose, might look at Second Life and say, well, wait a minute, you're doing the same kinds of things that you do in your daily life. What exactly, in what way is that different? Does it enable you to do things that somehow in your actual life you couldn't do?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because some people do use virtual worlds to do very different things that they couldn't do in the physical world. And one of the common examples that's trotted out is people with disabilities who can walk and act and look like anyone else in a virtual world. And for certain kinds of people with certain kinds of disabilities, that can be incredibly empowering. But then there are all kinds of folks who are going into virtual worlds and doing things where they sit around with friends and watch a TV, a video streaming, and sort of watch TV together or go to a shopping mall to buy clothes for their avatar. And in some ways, those are almost more interesting because they seem not interesting in a certain sense. They seem sort of obvious, or what are you getting out of that? And then for a researcher like me, then that becomes interesting. What are people getting out of it? And that becomes very interesting to me.
And roughly speaking, how many people participate in Second Life?
The exact numbers are always hard to know for sure, because unlike some virtual worlds where there's a monthly registration fee, Second Life has free registration and you can have as many accounts as you want. So there's several different measures that people use to try and figure out, you know, how many people are in Second Life. In terms of the maximum number of people of concurrency who are in there at once, right now it's just like past the 70,000 mark. The total number of avatars is above 15 million, I believe, now. But once again, that includes defunct accounts, people who have multiple accounts. And then if you look at the number of people who've logged in the last month, I haven't looked at the recent statistics, but that's often around a million or a little more. So it's really hard to say. There's probably somewhere between 500,000 and 2 million people who are sort of in a fairly engaged way doing something in Second Life.
Yeah, and I suppose one of the things that does make that difficult, as you explained, is that it's possible for a person to be in there and have more than one avatar, or I suppose it's also possible for a number of people to take turns being, you know, directing that avatar. So to come up with some precise number, it's kind of fluid, so to come up with a precise number is going to be difficult.
It's difficult, and that's, to me, this is an interesting thing about virtual worlds around this issue of what we can call embodiment, that the one body to one personality or one person can be broken in either direction, as you just said, multiple people controlling one avatar or one person having multiple avatars, both of which are things that are quite difficult to do in the physical world. Now, we want to note that that's not an inevitable feature of virtual worlds. You could have a virtual world that you would require you to use your physical world name, where I'd have to be Tom Bellstorff, you'd have to be David Inge, you'd have to give out like your credit card information or something, and you'd have to have your same name, and you'd only be allowed to have one avatar. Mm-hmm. So there aren't really any virtual worlds, to my knowledge, so far that do exactly that, but you could easily imagine that happening. And so this issue around embodiment and multiple identities and avatars is fascinating, and it's actually probably the more common thing in virtual worlds right now. But it's not an inevitable feature of virtual worlds, but it is quite common.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Tom Bellstorff, is Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Irvine, and he is the author of the book Coming of Age in Second Life, An Anthropologist Explores the Virtually Human, published by the Princeton University Press. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let me ask you a question or two about being an anthropologist and doing ethnography in a virtual world.
Sure.
Part of the your intended audience for the book, I'm sure, is, as you explain, is other anthropologists or people, grad students in anthropology. They will get the very conscious reference to Margaret Mead's very famous book, Coming of Age in Samoa, with the title that you've chosen, Coming of Age in Second Life. So as a layperson, though, I'm interested in this idea of doing anthropology in cyberspace, essentially. I suppose some people say, well, wait a minute, it's not real. How do you do that exactly?
Sure. Now, that's a really interesting whole set of questions. And, you know, one thing about that is that there's sort of a stereotypical image of what anthropology does, where you're sort of going on to the remote island, and I sort of begin my book invoking that sort of classic image of what anthropology does. But contemporary anthropology is much, much more diverse. And I'm actually very fortunate right now to be editor-in-chief of American Anthropologist, which is the flagship journal of the American Anthropological Association. And I see all of the incredible range of work that people are doing. And actually, just to give a brief shout-out at Champaign-Urbana, where I understand that you are, there's a really wonderful anthropology department, and I have many friends and colleagues there. And if you look at the range of the work that they do, then to do research in Second Life might not seem quite so strange, because there are anthropologists nowadays who study laboratories, who study the military, who study cults, who study gangs, who study anything. They aren't just going to some sort of remote island. Now, that said, of course, cyberspace to some people may be something different. It doesn't seem real to people, especially if they aren't familiar with it. And I wasn't completely sure myself. I mean, when I started this research 5 years ago, Second Life had only 5,000 accounts, and the maximum number of people in the world at once at any one time was around 200. It was much smaller, right? And so I actually had that same exact question. That was part of the experiment of this book, in a sense, was, you know, can we study these things ethnographically? Are virtual worlds robust enough or real enough, like you said, to be able to study them? And that was part of the enjoyment and the fun of this research project, was actually part and parcel of it, was to see, is that possible? And the answer, to me at least, I think most people would agree, is a resounding yes, that it is very possible, and that there's really important questions that we need to look at, and that, you know, virtual worlds can have positive and negative effects. They're not, you know, the wonderful answer to all problems, you know, nor are they enslaving humanity. And so we really need to understand what's going on with them, what's at stake with them, and what can we learn about everyday life from virtual worlds, but also what can we learn about virtual worlds themselves as they're changing and growing so quickly.
Yeah, and I suppose that it's true that if you say, well, again, take the classic example, what people think of as what the anthropologist does, the person who goes to look at a group of people who are very different than he is, and try to figure out, well, what's important to them, what's their worldview, how do they communicate with each other, what are some of their rules for dealing with each other in daily life, what do they think about big metaphysical questions like life, death, the universe, and everything, and try to learn all of those things. And I suppose you do a lot of that both by observing people, but by living with them and just spending a lot of time talking with them and asking them questions. And I suppose there's really no reason why you couldn't do that in Second Life. It's basically the same kind of stuff. It's spending time there, living with these people in the virtual world, looking at how people live, how they relate to one another, and then doing what you did, which was in a deliberate way, saying to people, look, I'm here, this is what I'm doing. I'm really interested in asking you some questions. Is that okay? Can we do that? And then conducting interviews, though with people I gather that you actually never met face-to-face, but communicated with through the computer in the virtual world.
That's right. Well, there's two interesting issues that you raise there. And one is, in the history of anthropology, there are many different traditions, but in terms of what do anthropologists do in terms of fieldwork, cultural anthropology, there are sort of two main traditions, and one comes from England, from the UK, and is associated with this guy, Malinowski. And his model, he did work off the coast of Papua New Guinea, halfway around the world, and it was very much about trying to understand people who were extremely different, but what kind of common humanity do we have? How can we understand each other? And then another tradition is actually the American tradition that was based around Franz Boas, who was an early anthropologist from Germany who founded the anthropology department at Columbia. And he and his students, and Margaret Mead was one of his students actually, they didn't have that same way of looking at things because they were often studying Native Americans or people in the U.S. where they would just go for a few weeks in the summer sometimes and then come back. They weren't necessarily going halfway around the world. And I didn't want to name names in your department there at Champaign-Urbana because I have so many friends there and I don't want to, like, you know, whatever. But I have to name one, which is Maddie Bunzel, who's there, you know, has talked very interestingly about how we often forget that second Boas tradition and overemphasize the Malinowski one. But there is this tradition in anthropology that is not based on someone who's really different, that actually is about studying people who may be much more like you. And I think it's completely possible to use anthropology to study these kinds of things. And then the second issue that you raised about, did I meet people in the physical world? And I very consciously chose not to do that. Now, of course, I did in a few cases end up meeting people in the physical world. But the reason why I didn't is actually quite simple. In Second Life, even when there were only 5,000 people in it, they, for the most part, didn't meet each other in the physical world. They were coming, logging in from all over the U.S. and all over the world. Early on, it was much more U.S.-centric. But even then, there were people from all over the world. Now, when there's 70,000 people there at once, you know, millions of different accounts, there's whole areas of Second Life that are Italian-speaking, German-speaking, Chinese-speaking. The vast majority of these people never meet in the physical world. But in Second Life, they interact. They sometimes become friends. They sometimes become lovers and have sex in Second Life or get married in Second Life or just have very close relationships. And they never meet in the physical world, either because they don't want to reveal their identities to each other, or maybe they do, but it's just too far away and, you know, it's just not practical. So the social relations, the culture that's happening in Second Life is not dependent on meeting face-to-face in the physical world. It's dependent on the physical world in the sense that people have to have computers and electricity and to be able to, like, type into a keyboard or whatever. But they don't have to meet in the physical world for Second Life to work, if you see what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. They very rarely do. Sometimes they'll meet each other if they find out that someone they've met in Second Life maybe doesn't live that far away, or they really fall in love with someone, and even though they do live far away, they try and meet, and sometimes they even get married in the physical world. You do absolutely hear those kinds of stories. I talk about some of them in the book, but that stuff isn't necessary for what happens inside a Second Life. And when you're an anthropologist, you want to follow the target. You want to follow what it is that you're studying. So if they aren't meeting in the physical world, at least not most of the time, it's not necessary for the culture there, then why should I be doing that? It would be doing a kind of mistaken violence almost to trying to understand what's happening there. So part of the experiment was to, you know, play ball, to do what they're doing and do the social interaction only in the virtual world. And, you know, if I meet some people in the physical world, it's not like I'm going to ignore that, but I'm not going to make it necessary for my research. And it worked wonderfully. I got wonderful data, wonderful stories, wonderful participation in the virtual world on its own terms in that sense, understanding those social interactions. Yeah. Now, a final point to make on that, this is for an ethnographic study, right? Studying a culture. Now, you could easily imagine, and I have many colleagues who are studying other issues of virtual worlds where it might be really useful to also interview people in the physical world. It all depends on the research questions that you have. So let's say you were doing a study of how people who can't walk, paraplegics, use Second Life and how it affects their everyday life. Well, maybe in that set case, I'm just making this up, you would want to meet people in the physical world. It all depends on the questions that you're trying to answer, and you can't answer every question with a single research project. It's just not doable. One of the keys to good research, as any researcher knows, is you have to narrow what you're going to study or you'll never finish, right? And so it's in doing what I'm doing, I'm not saying that meeting people in the physical world is irrelevant or never useful, just that you don't have to do that for the kind of research that I was interested in doing in Second Life.
Mm-hmm. I'm expect that probably people will have a lot of different questions, but one question that I suppose is asked all the time, maybe that is the ultimate question, is for people who participate in Second Life or perhaps in other virtual worlds, what precisely is the appeal? Why do they do it?
Right. Well, there's, and of course, for those kinds of big questions, I always have to say either I can't answer or there's lots of answers, right? And
well, I'm sure there's a different answer. There may indeed be a different answer for every person who participates. That is, different individuals have different motivations and they get different sorts of things out of it. So, I recognize right up front, well, yeah, there really is probably no one single answer to, well, what did people get out of it?
But you're right, there are clusters of answers. I mean, this is part of the interesting thing that you learn as an anthropologist. And, you know, one thing that I'm really glad about in doing this research is that this book is actually my third book. I'm also, for 15 years, I've been doing research in Indonesia on sexuality, actually, on gay and lesbian Indonesians and globalization, how the term gay has ended up halfway around the world in Indonesia and how that changes. And I actually have a book, The Gay Archipelago, that came out in 2005, and a second book called A Coincidence of Desires that came out in 2007. And I'm really glad that that's been my career trajectory, because I found that many of the issues that people think are unique to studying cyberspace or virtual worlds are actually questions about studying people. They actually aren't unique to virtual worlds. And I think for myself, having that earlier research, which I continue to do in Indonesia, has given me a helpful perspective on these things. And I mention that because even in my research in Indonesia, what you always find out when you do ethnographic research is, first of all, everyone's unique. No one's a robot. Everyone has their own reasons. But number two, culture does matter, and people's answers cluster. And they're, you know, it's not like it's a everyone for themselves, and there's no patterns to be found. You're absolutely right about that. And so in terms of people's motivations for something like Second Life, because it's also quite new, you know, there's an early sort of geek adoption thing where people who are really into technology, who'd maybe been participating in what were known as MUDs, multi-user domains or multi-user dungeons, which were text-only virtual worlds that go back 15 years, 20 years, those were some of the early people involved in virtual worlds, or people who are really interested in gaming and trying to make games inside of Second Life or use Second Life for gaming kinds of purposes. And then there are a set of people who use Second Life as a kind of fantasy escape from everyday life. So they want to go into Second Life and create an avatar that has nothing to do with their everyday identity. It's an animal or it's a different gender, and they do something very different than what they would do in their everyday life. And then there's people who, this is what one researcher referred to as immersionists versus augmentationists, that there's also people who use Second Life to sort of augment their everyday life. So maybe they're a teacher who uses Second Life to do something extra with the class. Or there's now many companies from Cisco to IBM that use Second Life to have company meetings, and they can bring together all over the world people and work on product development and save huge amounts of money on airline tickets by just meeting inside of Second Life. There's families who are separated, who live in different cities, who meet in Second Life, and instead of just trading emails, they can actually do stuff together. They can ride a roller coaster together in Second Life, or attend a garden together in Second Life, or go hear a music concert together. And of course, one person can have multiple motivations, right? One person could, you know, a couple days a week be going into Second Life for fantasy sorts of purposes, and on other days go to hang out with their daughter who's gone off to college, and instead of calling on the phone, they meet in Second Life and can do things together in Second Life. So there really are a range of options or reasons why people do things. And you know, this immersion versus augmentation, Hendrik Bennetsen is the name of the guy who first came up with that dichotomy, I think is accurate in terms of some one way of talking about reasons why people participate in virtual worlds. But as the virtual worlds get bigger and there's more in them, then there's more motivations or more purposes. So, for instance, there's now companies using virtual worlds like Second Life for language learning. Let's say I want to learn Italian. Instead of listening to a tape or a CD in my car, I go into Second Life and I can hang out with native Italian speakers and practice Italian and actually do things together and talk about it. And, you know, there's research showing that language learning is much more effective if you're actually doing something and not just sitting there. And many language learning companies are really seizing on these virtual worlds as a big growth market, as a real way to do something very new and innovative around language learning. Mm-hmm. So there's a new motivation that when I started my Second Life research was not there, right? So I think as these virtual worlds change and grow, there's really interesting parallels to the early internet. When the internet got started in the late 80s, early 90s, there was no eBay, there was no Amazon.com, universities didn't have websites yet very much. And people said, what do people do with the internet? What are you going to do here, right? What do you, and the technology often runs ahead of figuring out what the actual uses will be. And I think we're in a similar situation where we still don't know exactly how virtual worlds are going to get used. And there's some ways that they're getting used right now that might end up being rather minor ways in which they're being used in the future, and new uses that we just can't envision right now. You know, in the early 90s, no one thought that Facebook would be there. No one had heard of a blog and realized that there'd be millions of blogs out there. And I think a similar thing is going to happen with virtual worlds in the next 10 to 15 years, where as they become more common, as they become more effective, as they become more user-friendly, we're going to see all kinds of new uses for virtual worlds emerge that we just can't really imagine right now.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Tom Belsdorf. He is an associate professor of anthropology at the University of California, Irvine, and among other things is very interested in virtual worlds. And you might like to take a look at the book that he's written that explores one in particular, Coming of Age in Second Life, an anthropologist explores the virtually human. That's the title. The subtitle is published by the Princeton University Press. We have someone who'd like to join in the conversation here, someone in Indiana. Other folks you'd like to call in, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll talk with our Indiana caller right here, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. First, I'd like to put out my bias. I'm one of those people who will choose to pick up a 3x5 card to write a note down about something rather than go find my computer and put it into some folder. I think what you found, it all sounds very glitzy to me. It sounds like some of my buddies who are gamers who think that, you know, doing certain games with certain people around the world is about as high as you can possibly get in the world. I find that very puzzling. Secondly, I think what you actually opened up is a nice niche for a lot of doctors' dissertations to a nice, easy field for people to sit at the desk and punch the keys and turn out a thesis. Could you do a thumbnail sketch, so to speak, of a, say, a Boaz construct of something and what you would do with the second world construct in terms of explaining something to somebody about interaction or whatever your field of interest is. Thank you.
Sure. Well, there's several things there. I'll try to answer some of them. I mean, there are definitely going to be more, you know, doctoral dissertations on these virtual worlds. I think that's great. But I can tell you, as someone who is fluent in the Indonesian language and has spent many years in Indonesia doing research on the island of Sulawesi and on the islands of Bali and Java as well, that doing research in a virtual world is hard work. And, you know, even though I don't have to fly over to Indonesia and get a visa, it really does require a commitment of time and learning technology and spending time with people. And so, you know, I actually hope there will be more dissertations in the future on all kinds of things about virtual worlds and online games. They're going to be an important part of human life over in Indonesia as well, by the way, not just here. And but I don't think it's necessarily easy. It is nice I don't have to get on a plane and fly into Indonesia, but it's still real research and still real work. So I would want to emphasize that. And then the second point that you're, you know, hitting on is I'm not saying, and I don't think anyone who researches these topics is saying, that it's going to become something for everyone, because it doesn't have to be an interesting thing to research. I mean, there's a lot of interesting research out there on cell phones, and not everyone has a cell phone or uses a cell phone. To research it doesn't mean that you believe everyone should own a cell phone. It just means that you recognize that lots of people own cell phones, and we should figure out how it is that they're using them, right? And so, you know, anthropologists sometimes study communities of just a few hundred people. That's what Malinowski did, or what, you know, Boas did in some cases. And because the community is small or large, doesn't have really anything to do with whether or not we can learn something from it in terms of our research. And then in terms of sort of looking at something from a Boasian perspective, I won't answer that in detail because I don't want to run out the whole time of the hour here and get into a theoretical debate on anthropology, even though I'd certainly love to do that. But, you know, Boas was very interested in arguing for common humanity, for the common humanity of us all. And he was very involved in anti-racist debates. Anthropologists have been actually since the 19th century. And so, you know, he was interested in sort of how can we learn about all the different cultures of the world and all the different ways that people live their lives and all that incredible difference as a way to also get a better appreciation for a common humanity? What are things that we share? And in some ways, what we share are our differences, right? And by learning about those, we become more human in a sense. And so one reason that the subtitle of my book is about the virtually human, looking at that, is one thing I talk about in the book is that virtual worlds are very new, and some things about them are very new. But one thing we can learn from virtual worlds is certain ways in which humans have always been virtual. Since, you know, we had cave paintings where we created virtual worlds in a sense, you know, on the walls of a cave, or since the invention of the novel and people telling stories that, you know, are really rich. Those aren't the same things as virtual worlds, but they share something. They share something. And so I think trying to think about that common humanity from studying a specific culture is something that Boas and his students were very interested in, and that's an interest that I share.
Right. Again, other questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. What's one thing in particular I thought was kind of interesting I wanted to ask you about? It is the case, I think, that within Second Life there are distinct, people have distinct ideas about how, you know, say, within that frame, how we behave, what we do, how we do things. And so in that sense, I guess you would say that there is a culture in the anthropological sense in Second Life. One of the things I'm interested in is the matter of communication and the fact that the way that people talk to each other is by typing on their keyboards, and that it would be possible to rig it up so that people could actually speak to each other. But apparently there's a very strong, at least a goodly number of people within Second World who are really opposed to that idea about actually people with their voices talking to each other, and they want to keep the method of communication the way that it is. And I'm just interested in that as an issue and why that would be an issue.
Sure. Well, in August 2007, right, as my book was going off to the press to get published, they added voice capability to Second Life. And I don't have the statistic right with me, so I'm going to mangle it. But I believe that Second Life now has as many minutes of voice as Skype. Hmm. It's like second after Skype, or is almost the same as Skype, even though it's got a much, much smaller number of participants. So there's actually now massive, massive use of voice inside of Second Life that was not there even a year ago. It's been a huge change that this, you know, voice capabilities have been introduced. But even now that those voice capabilities have been introduced, there are a quite substantial percentage of people who do not like to use voice, who refuse to use it or don't want to use it. And there's multiple reasons for that, which are the same reasons that were there when I was doing my research for the book, and people were debating about should the company Linden Lab actually introduce the voice technology or not. And like I said, they did, I believe it was in August 2007. But there were multiple reasons for that. One was that there were people who felt that voice somehow brings in the physical world too much. It makes it, quote unquote, too real or too close to the actual world, in the sense that it makes it easier to identify someone's gender, the country they're from, the languages that they, you know, is their native language to speak. There's people all over the world who can type English okay, especially because when you're typing in chat, people are very tolerant of making errors and misspellings and such, but who can't speak or understand spoken English as easily, right, in terms of their language, where they are in terms of language learning. And so people felt it would make it less international and balkanize it by, you know, languages, so that you'd have more difficulty in communication. And then people who were involved in certain kinds of role playing, where maybe they wanted to be a different kind of person, a different gender, you know, whatever, then if they speak, that's going to be harder to hide. Of course, even with chat, you can, people who are men and women often type differently, right? And so these issues aren't unique to voice, of course, but people saw that as a real concern. And so now even the voice has been introduced, not everyone uses it, but also the very interesting thing that you see is people are often using a mix of voice and chat. So, for instance, if you're if I'm speaking at an event in Second Life, sometimes I use all chat, but often they'll have me speak in voice and people will have questions. They will type them in chat, and then that doesn't interrupt the flow of the conversation. And so that can actually be really useful for certain kinds of business meetings or any kind of meeting where some people talk and then some people are chatting back. And so that, you know, the chat is not going away. It's still getting used in all kinds of interesting ways. And then around disability issues, there were people who, there's quite a few people who are deaf or who have difficulties in hearing who are in Second Life who felt that they would be left out with voice. But then on the other hand, there were people with certain kinds of disabilities, let's say recovering from a stroke or something, who have great difficulty typing, who said they wanted voice because there was a kind of discrimination against them in the world that was text only because they could not type very well, could not type very quickly. And so, you know, there were also those kinds of debates. And so what seems to have happened is now you have both. And if you own land in Second Life, you can prohibit voice from working on that piece of land, or you can have it enabled, and then people can either choose to use it or not as they see fit. And I think, once again, what you're seeing is sort of a broadening, where you have some people now that use voice as the dominant way of interacting with people, some people who never use it, and then a whole mid-range of people who use it for certain purposes or certain occasions, and then on other occasions they'll use chat.
We have another caller to talk with. This is someone in Chrisman, again on our toll-free line. This is line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a kind of a question. You're going to have to kind of leap outside of where your research is. What do you feel is the disadvantage, especially for rural areas that aren't going to have access to high-speed internet? I mean, it seems to be more and more of an issue that rural areas are going to be kind of on the wrong side of the digital track, so to speak. And a lot of these worlds are going to be outside of what their connections can handle. You know, I'm pretty much moving down from around Chicago to back here around Chrisman. You know, I've had to give up all my massive worlds role-playing games because I can't get the connection to do what I want to do.
Well, that's an interesting question. What do you think?
That's a great question. And I actually grew up in Nebraska, so I can empathize with the rural. I mean, I live mostly in Lincoln, but my family's from a rural area in Nebraska. And so growing up, we had a party line. We didn't have our own telephone line out there on the farm. So I can empathize with the rural issues. The interesting thing is I think it goes both ways. So on the downside, there's the issue of broadband access. And, you know, out on the farm in Nebraska where my family is, they have a real hard time getting broadband access still. There's kinds of satellite things they can use, but they're expensive. They're not always reliable. It's getting better, but it's still not great. And so that can be a kind of barrier. But then on the flip side, in rural areas where they do get broadband access, virtual worlds can be incredibly useful or enabling from people for all kinds of distance working or community building. So, for instance, let's say people who have a certain kind of cancer who live in a rural area can go into Second Life and go to the American Cancer Society area, and instead of just a web page, they can actually get counseling. They can meet other people who have their same condition. They might be the only person in their county where they live that has it, but they can have a support group of 20 people with their exact same cancer, and they can share tips, they can share ideas, they can give each other emotional support in a way that they couldn't do otherwise in that rural area where they're living. Or because, you know, you can make and sell things inside of Second Life. I know cases of people who live in very rural areas that are making $500, $1,000, $5,000 a month selling shirts for avatars because they're really good at clothing design. They've got a good eye for it. They can design clothes in Photoshop for avatars and sell them in Second Life in a way that that would just not be an income option that would be available to them in a rural area otherwise. So it goes both ways, I think. There are concerns that if you don't have broadband access, then you're getting shut out of these things, and not just virtual worlds, but the internet in general. Virtual worlds often require more downloading power, more faster streaming than just a regular website, but that issue is there for email, for everything, if you don't have access to the internet and ideally to broadband. You're absolutely right. But then the flip side of that is for people in rural areas who do have that, virtual worlds can be useful in all kinds of ways that they may not have predicted. I mean, I've been shocked in the last 10 years going back to Nebraska, all the people in this rural area of Nebraska where my family's from, who are making often quite a bit of their income through eBay, because there's all these old farm implements and antiques and stuff out in the rural area that it used to be that you'd take it to the antique store in the little local town of 30,000 people, but who goes through that town to buy stuff? Now on eBay, they can get top dollar selling stuff to New York, overseas, other parts of the U.S. And so, you know, in terms of the ways that these technologies affect rural areas, I think there's actually a lot of promise and a lot of good stuff that can happen. But there's a big if there that you're absolutely right in hitting on. And the big if is there has to be broadband access in rural areas. And I think that's a basic issue of, you know, just like we need to have good highways, you know, in rural areas, not just in cities, the broadband issue is a similar issue. And as long as that's taken care of, then I think there can potentially be some really positive possibilities for rural communities.
Well, I'm definitely on board for what you advocate, the possibilities. I'm just more concerned about the restricted access and the, you know, almost the digital segregation that we're going to get here in this country in a lot of cases.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, that is a political issue, and it's an issue of politics and economics and choices. There's no inevitable reason that that has to be the case, but right now it is, and if that continues, it will be a problem. Absolutely. And so I completely agree. That's why I say it's a big if, because I know from, you know, what folks in Nebraska are dealing with, that if you don't have access to it, then it's all irrelevant, and it's actually exclusionary. It really creates a two-tier society of people who have access and people who don't. So there's great potential and positive potential there, but you're absolutely right that there's a big if, and that is a question of access to broadband that is of a reasonable price, you know, that's not $1,000 a month or something, and is good internet access. And I really, you know, where my family lives, we, you know, had water from wells until fairly recently. And I think it's the same. It's of a piece with, you know, my dad, where he was born, there wasn't electricity in the house yet. And so it's just this issue of all utilities, you know, getting access to those things to rural areas, electricity, water, roads. And now I think broadband should be put in that category of something that every American, every person should have access to, and then if they don't want to use it, fine, but I think it should be there as an option, obviously, and so it's easy to say, it's harder to pull off, but I completely sympathize. You're absolutely right on that point.
All right, well, thanks for the call.
Thank you so much.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of the show. Our guest is Tom Belstorff. He is Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of California at Irvine, and among other things, is interested in the anthropology of virtual worlds. He is the author of the book Coming of Age in Second Life, An Anthropologist Explores the Virtually Human, and it is published by Princeton University Press. I just want to go back to something that you said, because I want to make sure that people heard it, or people would be thinking, now, wait a minute, you said that there was someone who designed and sold clothing, virtual clothing, to avatars in cyberspace who is actually making real money. They're making real-world money doing that.
Absolutely. And this is an interesting thing that is carried to an extreme in Second Life, although it is not unique to Second Life by any matter. Basically, what happened is early on, the company that runs Second Life, Linden Lab, made a decision they were going to try and make a world that was user-generated. So instead of hiring people in the company to design, you know, houses and clothes and dragons to slay or whatever it's going to be, they would create basically a platform, a place, an empty world, and that people would make the things that would then attract more people to come into the world, because people know best what other people want. This is sort of their philosophy. And so to encourage people to create stuff for this world, they decided that they would make it possible for people to earn money and have a profit motive for creating things in Second Life. Now, you can create things in Second Life and give them away for free, and it's amazing to see all of the sort of virtual altruism that you see in Second Life, because there's enormous amounts of clothing and homes and plate and whatever stuff that people create and give away for free, because it's just the joy of building and the joy of creativity. They love doing it. But there is a currency inside of Second Life called the Linden dollar, and it is convertible with U.S. dollars. And so you can, if you wish, create something in Second Life. You can give it away for free, or you can have it set so that it sells for a certain amount of money. And then that money is deposited into your avatar's account as Linden dollars, and then you can cash that out into U.S. dollars and thereby make money. And so not everyone in Second Life by any means is selling things for money, but thousands of people are, and some people make a little bit of money off of that, and then there's a few people who have made more than $1 million U.S. By selling things in Second Life. Real estate actually is a big way to make money in Second Life, because the land in Second Life is paid for and owned, and then you can sell that land to other people for any price you want. So I can buy a piece of land in Second Life, like a beautiful piece of land on a beach, and I can buy it for $2,000 London. And if I can get someone to buy it from me, sell it to them for $5,000 London, then I've just made a profit. And people who are good at that can make a lot of money. And basically why you would want to own land in Second Life is it allows you to build things that persist, that then remain. And basically land is acting as a kind of metaphor for space on a server. It's a way to store content, is basically what's going on there. You can also make money for anything you want. You could buy shirts. You could create furniture for people to sell in houses. You can provide services. So you could be a DJ at an event or a musician who plays music. You could be a prostitute and give, you know, have people pay you to have sex inside of Second Life. You could maybe be an English teacher and people would pay you and then you would teach them English for an hour. You could do anything you want. And if people will pay you to do it, then you could earn money doing it. So you can sell items or land, or you could provide a service and earn money that way in Second Life. And not everyone does that, but a lot of people do. And then that also has created an attraction, one of the attractions for companies to set up shop inside of Second Life and sell items inside of Second Life. A lot of companies who come into Second Life, corporations like Microsoft or whatever, are doing it more as a kind of promotion for their company, so they actually aren't selling stuff. You know, quite a few of them don't sell things, but some are using it as a way to try and sell virtual items.
Hmm. We're coming down the point, we have about 5 minutes left, and there's lots and lots of interesting stuff to talk about. I guess one of the point, maybe as a way of kind of finishing up, one of the points I think you make in the book, and it's a good thing to remind people, is that people, humans, have been creating virtual worlds for a long time. It didn't just start when we had computers and with the idea of cyberspace and the internet. It certainly didn't start there. Maybe what the technology we have now, though, maybe it gives you the ability to inhabit the virtual world in a way that we didn't have before. But the idea is not new. So then there's this question of, in a larger sense, the creation of virtual worlds, the desire to inhabit them. What that really means, particularly in terms of how people think about their identity, what identity is, how people form them, is it possible to have more than one, how do you inhabit alternate identities, all sorts of really interesting questions that I know you yourself are interested in.
Absolutely. I mean, there's two or three really interesting topics there. I mean, one is that I think and I sort of, you know, talk about this in the book, that perhaps the number one question for us with virtual worlds is what is new and what's not about them. Because when something new shows up like virtual worlds, there's often a lot of hype. You know, people act like it's totally new. And then there's often a lot of anti-hype where people say this has all been done before, which is also wrong. And so I think there's a real pressing need to try and get our heads around what's new and what's not. And there's a lot of ways to define what virtual world means. In the book, I put forth a definition of places of human culture realized through the internet, that I try and be narrow enough to catch the right things and not include everything. But then also I talk about all of these linkages. So like I said before, in a way, some people we've had virtual worlds since cave paintings, depending on how you define it. You know, novels are a kind of virtual world, and actually things like Lord of the Rings were very influential in the early creation of virtual worlds. Now, when I read a novel, I can't buy land inside of there. The characters in the novel don't respond or change based on my reading of it. I can't meet other people inside that novel. It doesn't keep changing when I set it down and leave it for a day or two. So it's not, as I would say, I would not call it a virtual world. It's obviously not the same thing. We don't want to conflate everything, because then it's hard to really say anything about anything in an interesting way. But we also don't want to isolate everything. You know, there's a happy medium where we identify what's unique about these things, but then we also are really cognizant and keeping aware of what are the linkages between these things. And so, for instance, I talk about in the book about the history of love love letters when people say, well, how could people fall in love in Second Life, you know, when they never meet? Well, there's, you know, a history going way back of people writing letters back and forth and having these incredible emotional relationships that they may actually never meet or have only met once, and it's carried entirely through correspondence, right? So the idea of, you know, long-distance stuff, there were marriages taking place over the telegraph in the 1840s. You know, so there is a history to these kinds of things. But the telegraph is not a virtual world. And so I think it's very interesting as a researcher. I think one of the most interesting areas for continuing debate and research is to really pin down what's unique about virtual worlds and what is the legacy and the thing that it shares with other kinds of technologies like cell phones, email, the internet more generally, websites, and also historically what are the things that it shares. So I think that all of those issues, I think, are really important and interesting things to keep thinking about as we look forward.
Mm. And how do people – there's really not enough time for a very good answer, but how do people deal with the reality that the person that they are relating to in Second Life is a fiction? That is, that the person who is behind the avatar may be somebody completely different from the person that they're relating to within Second Life.
That's right. Well, there's many different ways that that can happen. And once again, people bring tools to these things, right? People have from the actual world, in the sense that we aren't always the same person in everyday physical world life either, right? Yeah, our identity changes whether we're at school or at work or at home or hanging out with our friends or at a bar or whatever. And so the idea of people not always being quite the same is already there, but it can be quite different in you know, virtual worlds. And there's one, you know, case that, you know, changed some details, but to give you the basic idea of, you know, a man who was participating in Second Life as a woman, just to sort of experiment with gender, saw another woman in Second Life. They started having a sexual relationship as two lesbians, but then they started to sort of fall in love and tell each other about their day and really get to know each other and become dear friends, and eventually this guy decided to reveal to his partner, actually, I'm not a lesbian woman, I'm actually a straight man. And the other person said, oh my God, I'm actually a straight man as well. And so you had two straight men who were in a romantic relationship. When they found out, they laughed about it and ended the relationship. But they actually felt they were friends in a kind of way they never would have been otherwise, and remained friends, even though they ended the sexual side of things. But it had actually given them a chance to know each other in a way that never would have been possible otherwise. Now, that's not a story that happens to every single person in Second Life, obviously, although there's many variations of that kind of thing that have happened in Second Life. It's not the only case by any means. It's not, you know, what happens to every single person. But, you know, having those kinds of discrepancies can sometimes be devastating or horrible. You find out someone is someone that, you know, you hate, or that a kind of person you weren't expecting. But it can also be liberating in unexpected ways. And so, you know, people deal with those things as they arise. There's no one way that those things show up. And it doesn't happen to everyone. Once again, there's so many different kinds of things that can happen in these virtual worlds. But those kinds of things do happen. And I think that's one of the most interesting ways that virtual worlds can offer new possibilities for people in their lives.
So does that say to you, do you think that many people in their daily interactions feel somehow constrained? And that what this does is that gives people a freedom to try to relate to other people in ways that perhaps maybe they think they would like to, but they would feel that in the real world would just not be possible.
It's really hard to speculate, but it is true that in the modern world, if you compare it, you know, historically, we have very fixed identities. You know, people didn't used to have last names. People didn't used to have social security cards and passports and driver's licenses. And the internet actually, in some cases, forces us to have a single really consistent identity that you enter, you know, with your password all the time. You know, there historically have been cases where people could do a lot more role-playing than they used to, you know, than they can do nowadays, perhaps. I'm not sure that's true, but one could make an argument that in at least for some people in their daily lives, the world isn't offering them the kinds of possibilities for play and for role-playing and creativity that they would like to have. And in that sense, going into a virtual like Second Life in some ways is escape, but in some ways it's becoming more real. And I'll never forget one of the most interesting things I heard during my research, short quotes that I often, you know, repeat, is when I was talking to someone and they said, you know, they felt that the friendships they made in Second Life were more real than the ones in the physical world. Mm-hmm. Because he said, in Second Life, you get to know people from the inside out, and in the physical world, it's from the outside in. And what he meant was, if I meet you in Second Life, in theory, I'm going to be less likely to prejudge you based on your age, on your race, how you look. Although there has been research showing if people have an African-American avatar, that will affect the way that they're seen. But in theory, you don't know if that person is young or old, urban or rural, whatever. You get to know them based on how they treat you and how they are with you.
We're gonna have to stop. Pardon me for interrupting, but we're just at the end of the time. Tom Belstorff is Associate Professor of Anthropology at UC Irvine. His book is Coming of Age in Second Life, Princeton University Press. Thanks very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.
Support for Focus 580 comes from the Infant Parent Institute. Celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign, the Institute has now established the Center for Men and Masculinity, aimed at research, clinical services, and education about boys and men. Information at menandmasculinity.com.
This is David Inge. We're planning another cooking show and looking for hearty chili, soup, and stew recipes. Send your recipe by January 2nd to Chili, Soups, and Stews, WILL-TV, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. We'll put together a cookbook and choose several chefs to join Doyle Moore and me for a live cooking special in March. Learn more at WILL.illinois.edu.
You're listening to AM 580, and thank you for making us a part of your Thanksgiving holiday. Today, we'll have sunny skies with highs in the lower 50s, west winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows around 30 degrees with west winds 5 to 10 miles per hour, and tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 40s, west winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. And tomorrow night, partly cloudy, lows in the upper